You're listening to Radio Diaries. This is Joe, and I have some exciting news from the Radiotopia family. Ear Hustle is back with a new season. Hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods are bringing you unique, surprising stories from four California prisons. This season, they have some truly interesting perspectives. You'll hear from people who are so comfortable in prison that they no longer want to be free. And you'll hear from mothers of inmates about the complicated reality of having adult children in prison. The show is full of candid interviews and thought-provoking conversations, and it just keeps getting better. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts and at earhustlesq.com. This episode of Radio Diaries is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. We also have support from Indeed. Finding new hires shouldn't feel like a second job, and that's why Indeed only matches you with quality candidates that fit your job description. Indeed makes hiring more organized. You can screen, message, and schedule interviews with candidates all in one place. So try it out. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/diaries. Just go to Indeed.com/diaries right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Radiotopia.
From PRX.
From PRX's Radiotopia, this is Radio Diaries. I'm Joe Richman. Recently, over Labor Day weekend, I came across a statistic that surprised me. A recent Gallup poll found that 71% of Americans approve of labor unions. That's the highest number since 1965. The stat got me thinking about an interview we did a few years back with Gary Briner, a former leader of the United Auto Workers. Briner was first interviewed by Studs Terkel for his 1974 book Working, which chronicled what people do all day and how they feel about what they do.
Boring, monotonous work. I don't give a shit what anybody says. It was boring and monotonous to work on an assembly line.
That's Briner in the early 1970s, talking about his work at a General Motors factory in Ohio. He was 29 at the time, and robotics was just beginning to change what it meant to work in a factory. Four decades later, we interviewed Briner and others from Studs Terkel's best-selling book for our series, Working Then and Now. Here's Studs with Gary Briner.
I'm somewhere between Youngstown and Warren, Ohio. It's an industrial area, steel, automobiles. Talking to Gary Briner. Gary Briner is the president of Local 1114, United Auto Workers. No, 1124.
1112.
1112. Well, what sort of plant is this?
It's the General Motors Vega plant in Lordstown.
The most automated plant in the world, isn't it?
Right. It's the fastest line speed in the world, and they've got the most modern equipment, the Unimates. They got 22 in a row, 11 on each side of the line.
Can you describe a Unimate?
Well, it looks like a robot, you know, and it reminds me of a praying mantis. When they took the Unimates on, we were building 60 an hour prior to the Unimates. And when we came back to work with the Unimates, we were building 101 cars per hour. See, they never tire, they never sweat, they never complain, they never miss work. They're always there.
Yeah. So what happened to the guys in the plant that are working there now?
It's a funny thing, you know, when they revamped the plant, they tried to take every movement out of the guy's day so that he could conserve seconds and time, so that they could make him more efficient, more productive.
Is the assembly line approach dependent upon the fact that each guy is exactly like the other guy?
Right. GM's reason for trying to be more efficient is that if they could take 1 second and save a second on each guy's effort, they would, over a year, make $1 million.
1 second?
That's right. You know, they used the stopwatches. And they say, look, we know from experience that it takes so many seconds to walk from here to there. We know that it takes so many seconds to shoot that screw. We know the gun turns so fast and the screw so long and the hole so deep. We know how long it takes. And that's what that guy's going to do. And our argument has always been, you know, that's mechanical. Mm-hmm. That's not human. Look, we tire, we sweat, we have hangovers, we have upset stomachs, we have feelings, emotions, and we're not about to be placed in a category of a machine.
This is something new, isn't it? The workers in the plant, they feel that they have a right in determining the nature of their work too, the working men?
We do now. We have some kind of pride being able to stand up to the giant General Motors Corporation and say, look, this is what I think is fair, and I'm willing to fight to show you that it's fair. I just think they want to be able to be treated with dignity and some respect, and you know, that's not asking a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
Well, it takes me back. I'm Gary Briner, retired, have been for 11 years. I didn't plan to be a union guy. I just wandered into it. In 1966 through 75, maybe later, the company and the union were bitter enemies. Every gain we made usually came out of a strike, and that's just the way it was. But the job of the union today is much tougher than it was for me in 1970 because the strength of the union has been so weakened. And look, the union's not perfect. I'd be the first to say it. But, you know, what we did in the union is to create this middle class that were able to do things, enjoy their life outside of work. And I worry about these things that we're losing. But listen, you got to have a job. No matter what it is, you got to have a job. It's one of those things that must be.
Picking it up with Gary, you feel this is shape of things to come?
I hope that it is, because I think what we're doing is right. You know, we're putting humans before profits, and I think that's necessary. I think if it isn't that way in other places, it should be.
Gary Briner, interviewed by Studs Terkel and by us at Radio Diaries 4 decades later. You're listening to Radio Diaries. This is Joe, and we want to recommend a new show we think you'll really like. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet for immigrant voices, has a new series out called Home Interrupted. It explores how climate change affects immigrant communities and how these same communities are leading the way with innovative solutions. Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported, original stories from across the United States. It takes you everywhere from flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farms in Nebraska. So give it a listen. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted, wherever you get your podcasts. One of the themes we found, revisiting Studs Terkel's book Working many years later, is how much work has changed. From a telephone operator to a private detective to a hotel bar piano player. But there was one story, and it's one of our favorites, about how much hasn't changed. Renault Robinson was one of Chicago's few black police officers in the 1970s. He was a founder of the Afro-American Patrolmen's League. Robinson spoke bluntly about tensions between the police and the black community.
I'm talking with Renault Robinson, and I'm thinking, Renault, why did you become a policeman?
Well, policeman is looked upon in the black community as an important thing. Even though people are afraid of him or people have bad thoughts about him, the position itself is still one of importance. I quit a job paying more money to become a police officer. And sometimes I wonder if that was the best decision to make.
Could you describe your day, the day of a policeman in uniform?
Well, first of all, you're given an assignment and a partner. Most of the white guys are wondering what black they're going to get today. And the black guys are wondering the same thing. Which one of these fools am I going to get today? The black cop is saying the only reason I'm with this white cop is because they want to protect his life while he's riding around the black community to ward off the bullets. And so, you know, there's hard feelings on both sides.
Well, what happens then during these 8 hours? You're sitting with this white guy.
say nothing to each other at all. Can you imagine that for 8 hours?
So there's no conversation?
Very little or none. Very little or none.
Got told Studs exactly what the situation was. My name is Renault Robinson, and when I first started on the police department, I went in there to do the best job I could as a policeman. But that became very difficult once I realized what the true circumstances were.
What led to your disenchantment?
I think it was just seeing blacks being treated one way and whites being treated another. You know, the majority of the policemen in my station were white. The opinions that they have of black people are that they're all criminals, they have no morals, no scruples, they're dirty and nasty, et cetera, et cetera.
So the trouble is with an ordinary citizen. Could you dwell on this?
Well, I would say about 60% of police citizen contact start on a traffic situation. Certain units have really developed a science around stopping the automobile. In other words, in their minds, if they stop 100 cars in the black community, the likelihood of them finding one or two or three violations of some sort is highly possible. Now, of course, after you've stopped 1,000, you've got 900 people who are very pissed off. Teachers, lawyers, doctors, or just average working people who haven't broken any law and are very irritated and aggravated about being stopped by the police. And black folks or minority tolerance of that police brutality has grown very short.
Because they won't accept it.
They won't accept that treatment. They won't accept that dehumanizing, degrading treatment. That's why more young kids are being killed by the police than ever before.
50 years later, whether it's Chicago or Baltimore or Detroit, the same thing is happening in all of these cities. It just feels like deja vu. At the time I joined the Chicago Police Department, I was young, and I guess I was very energetic about doing something about racism. You know, I remember they forced us to put sawed-off shotguns, police-issued, in the squad cars, loaded with 00 buckshot. If you're a hunter, you know what that is. I and, you know, a handful of other black police officers just felt that that was wrong. You're chasing a kid or chasing a stolen car and you got something that could tear somebody's head off. So the Afro-American Patrolman's League, we raised hell, we picketed, we marched, we did everything to get the police department to take those guns out of the squad cars. Of course, speaking out like that on a regular basis made me a popular fellow in the police department. You go into your locker room and you see in your mailbox is human feces and cigarette ashes and trash. You kind of know what that means. You go in the bathroom and there's a picture of you on the wall dressed as a native with a bone in your nose. You know how they feel. They were all knicky-knack stuff just to try and force me out of the department.
I know the fact that you now have the reputation of speaking out, speaking your mind. Every now and then you're suspended.
I've got a 30-day suspension pending now.
What do they use as grounds?
Well, this latest one, I'm being suspended because I was passing out literature in the police station to black police about the Patrolman's League. I was arrested in the station and I'm being suspended for conduct unbecoming a policeman.
In the end, I knew I had to go. I mean, I had fractured too many feelings and too many people who didn't want to hear what I had to say. And I left. I get a small pension now. And the beat goes on.
Renault Robinson, interviewed by Studs Terkel and by us at Radio Diaries 4 decades later. Today's stories are from our series Working Then and Now, which was a collaboration with Jane Sachs and Project AND. To listen to a full hour of these stories, visit our website, radiodiaries.org. The Radio Diaries team is Elisa Escarce, Micah Hazel, Nellie Gillis, and myself. Our editors are Ben Shapiro and Deborah George. Radio Diaries is part of Radiotopia, a network of the best story-driven podcasts around. You can find them all at radiotopia.fm. We have support from the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and from listeners like you. I'm Joe Richman. Thanks for listening.
Radiotopia.